Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 1st of August, and coming up on the program, the new crisis of civilians being killed by police in KwaZulu-Natal. Is South Africa failing when it comes to access to the law for marginalized communities? The pressure now really on for the implementation of the two-pot retirement system, new efforts to improve math literacy in South Africa, and do we need mandatory race diversity education in the classroom? So let's start with this. And police killing of civilians in KwaZulu-Natal is raising alarm bells, and says Professor Pierre de Vos, officers whose lives are endangered have the right to respond appropriately to protect themselves. But he goes on to say it doesn't justify the random killing of civilians who may or may not have been correctly identified as criminal suspects by one or the other. De Vos is the author of the blog Constitutionally Speaking. He joins me on the program first up today. And Professor, why do you think this is happening now with such alacrity?
Well, the problem is that we actually don't have enough information to know why this is happening. There's been clearly a spike in the number of suspects being killed by the police when the police say they are trying to arrest them and then so on. So the problem is that there's no explanation. Why is this suddenly happening? So the worry is that either the police is getting trigger happy, that they are doing this either deliberately, or they are at least don't mind, or they're okay with the fact that they would be in situations where they can kill all the suspects. And of course, the questions about whether in each of these cases what the police said happened really happened, we don't really know any of this.
So given this increase then, Pierre, how do you interpret what is almost public support for this?
Yes, so, you know, I'm not surprised by this because South Africa is an extremely violent country and rife with crime, and communities are obviously responding also to the kind of organized crime that the police in KZN is saying that they are dealing with. The problem is, though, that the public know from their own interactions with ordinary police officers every day that the police is not always the most competent body. Some police officers are good, but many are not really good. Some of the police officers are corrupt. All of these things, that sometimes the police overreact, they're violent. There are thousands of stories of that people can tell about how the police really went far beyond what they're supposed to. But they do not translate that personal knowledge they have to this situation where the police claim that they are specific violent criminals. It's a kind of desperation, a magical thinking, I would suspect. People want to see that something is done and they're desperate, and so they accept this even though they really know better that that they might not always be police acting in good faith.
Pierre de Vos, do you think there is a sense that senior command within the SAPS is turning a blind eye here?
Yes, so I hate these questions because it's a kind of speculation. I do think this is a question that should be asked, because the nature of this, the scope of the problem, if you will, is something that if you're the police commissioner in KZN, the National Police Commissioner, that you really at least should ask questions about it. And there's no publicly available evidence at the moment that this is happening in senior police echelon.
All right, let me move then from speculation to solution, if we can. Are there reforms or policies that you think should be implemented to better ensure police accountability?
You know, it is actually very difficult to hold the police accountable in any society because the police is a close-knit group. There are loyalties, it's dangerous work that cements these things, so police protect each other. And so we do have a system, the IPED system. There was a time when it was headed by Robert McBride, where it seemed to be trying to become more independent and ruffled many feathers. McBride was basically forced out. And maybe then, for me, the start of the solution would be to really secure IPED's independence. It is not fully independent, and to staff it for it to be headed by somebody who really cares about the police, but also really, really cares about the police not taking the law into their own hands, so that it can become a body that is trusted. The other solutions are political in nature. The minister should be holding these people accountable, but politically I think it is not feasible for him to be seen to criticize the police that is cheered on by the community.
So if the solution is with IPED, it would be important that there is an appetite to give it more teeth to facilitate the type of change that you're recommending. I'm not sure that exists, though.
No, Mr. We know that the previous police minister, Bheki Cele, actively tried to undermine IPED, championed the kind of legislation that ensured that IPED would not be as independent as it needed to be to actually investigate these claims as well as is required. And it's difficult because, investigating these things, as I said, is not easy because of police law.
And Pierre, finally then, beyond IPED itself, do we need to relook at legal frameworks that need to be strengthened, maybe as a deterrent?
There was a huge debate about 15 years ago when there was amendments made to the Criminal Procedure Act, the one that guides police officers and the use of force that they can use when they try to arrest people. It is, in the end, that it was a bit fudged, but I don't think we are beyond a situation where those small details is going to make a difference. Our law allows police to defend themselves, to use in self-defense to protect themselves. That is sufficient. It's not the law, I think, that is the problem. It is the politics and the culture, and of course the much deeper systemic issues that are the causes of crime, which is not something you can solve by passing legislation.
Professor De Vos, you've raised a very important issue, and thank you for ventilating it today. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, I want to stay in the legal orbit, and access to law in South Africa has always been a problem for the more marginalized. And now community law clinics offering free legal services to those who can't afford legal representation or support remain a lifeline for these individuals. But here's the question, are they sufficiently funded and capacitated? Fiona Kaplan is Dean of the Faculty of Law at the IIE Varsity College and joins me on the program now. And Fiona, do you believe community law clinics then are receiving adequate funding and resourcing?
It's a very good question, Jeremy. I think there's always room for more funding to be made available. Currently, most law clinics receive funding from the Legal Practice Council, but certainly in the future, we would value more funding to be received, as they have a very valuable role to play in the communities of South Africa, particularly at this juncture in our history.
Give me a sense of the day-to-day work and how valuable it is that they perform.
So law clinics are accessible to members of the public. They would normally make an appointment and come and see one of our experienced legal practitioners and meet with them. We have translators as well. The law clinics also serve a function by going into the community and meeting people where they're at and providing educational outreach programs. Those are held regularly, such as at old age homes, women shelters, schools, and even outside various local courts.
Apart from the money, are there other difficulties that these clinics face in providing those services, and how do they overcome the obstacles?
Well, the whole thing is getting the actual clients to come to our clinics. So very often we take our students out into the community. So certainly resourcing is something that is difficult to overcome. But the value of law clinics are certainly being recognized, especially how we can make an impact in local communities by offering free legal services to members of the public who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford private legal services. You know, litigation and access to legal services is beyond the reach of even middle-class citizens currently.
It's of great benefit to the community, as you've just outlined, Fiona, but I'm also assuming that invaluable to law students themselves.
Absolutely. So the law clinics play a twofold function of helping vulnerable members of the community, but it's also a wonderful opportunity for our final year law students, and it is a compulsory module for them to sit in on consultations with clients that are referred to the clinic. They take consultation notes, draft different pleadings, and under the supervision of our experienced legal practitioners. And also they learn important communication skills, answering telephones, and just general legal office roles that they would need to know for their future careers as legal practitioners.
Are you able to give me a sense of the type of cases that community law clinics typically handle?
They vary depending on the region. So we have clinics now in Cape Town, which opened in July this month, in Pretoria, and here in Durban. So the types of matters typically that are brought to our desks are family matters. It could be a protection order, harassment order. Of course, gender-based violence, there's a lot of referrals regarding that area of law. Labor matters, and even property disputes with neighbors and the like.
How do you think, Fiona, that law clinics then can be better supported to expand their services and reach more individuals?
Well, it would be wonderful if even more higher educational institutions, even in the private sector, were to open law clinics so that we could have a greater reach and go a long way towards providing greater support to communities. So making legal services more accessible to an even greater number of South African citizens, you know, the support from private sectors. And I think that faculties around the country recognize the importance of the services that are provided to members of the community through community law clinics.
What's preventing them from doing it then, if that is a need that you've identified?
It's budgetary considerations. So, you know, that they do, it takes a lot to run a law clinic. It's fully serviced and staffed by legal practitioners. And so it's a question of allocation of resources. And there's a lot of competing budgetary implications, you know, for law faculties around the country. So, but I do think that there's the possibility for law faculties through their law clinics to partner with private government authorities, as well as members of the private sector, towards increasing access to justice.
And what about law firms themselves? Is there a focus more on their own pro bono work, or do you find that there is good cooperation in that respect?
Since it's been gazetted last August for pro bono work to be done, we do have attorneys, advocates who come to the law clinics to offer their services pro bono and are agreeable to take on a matter to appear without charging for those fees. There's definitely an increased interest from legal practitioners to offer their services at a very reduced rate or very often pro bono. So that is certainly assisting vulnerable members of the community.
Well, thank you for opening a very important curtain on a critical issue. Fiona Kaplan, thank you indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And coming up on the program, do we need diversity training in the classroom and the risks of the two-pot retirement system effective in exactly 1 month's time? Now, despite high spending on education relative to other countries, South Africa scores poorly on many international education rankings. In 2004, the Centre for Development and Enterprise arguing that the country would need to double the number of matric higher grade maths and science passes for economic growth, a goal that was formally adopted about 2 years later. Obviously, this raises the issue of investing in maths proficiency. I'm going to talk now to Sarah Cairns, head of Epoch and Optima Trusts at the Chikululu, founded by Anglo-American. Sarah, welcome. Are we making any dent in the problem?
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for the opportunity. We started this program in 2007. That was really informed by what the CDE had to say about increasing the number of graduates with higher grade maths passes at the time. And we've done extensive evaluations over the last 15 years of the existence of the program. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that despite a number of efforts from the department as well as trusts like ours, only, of the total number of matrics that wrote maths last year, only 41,249 learners achieved a quality pass, what we say is 60% pass in mathematics. That's only 6% of the total number of learners that were writing the matric exams. And so to answer your question, I don't think we've got there.
But Sarah, you pushed the accelerator as far as this concept called the Maths Challenge Program is concerned. Obviously, there are positive learnings or lessons that have come out of that that maybe could be applied more broadly.
Yes. So our program, as I said, it started in 2007, and it was informed by what the CDE had to say about doubling growth. And the idea was that if you you allowed schools to drive what they needed in terms of increasing the number of quality maths passes, and allowed them the agency to decide, that you would then be able to increase those numbers. And we have seen, even though it's incremental, we have seen some improvement in maths passes. What we've also learnt over time is we spent a lot of time engaging with the data, and what we've learnt is to actually look at why these schools are not achieving the results that we were hoping for. And a lot of what those secondary schools have been saying is that they are dealing with quite significant backlogs, that they having to spend a lot of time catching up in order to get learners up to speed. And that then again informed us that perhaps we're starting too late. Perhaps we actually need to look earlier on at the early grades to make an impact.
Sarah, I'm wondering if I'm not detecting a vicious circle here. Is the problem poor teaching or a diminishing aptitude for mathematics because of poor teaching?
I think it might be a bit of both. I'm not sure it's about a diminishing aptitude generally. I think kids first of all come in, and if they're not able to grasp the concept of number by the end of grade one, they're mathematically stunted for life. So it starts as early as then, and when you've got primary school teachers who struggle with maths themselves teaching those kids, then already they're stunted. And as you know, you've got maths is a hierarchical subject, right? So if you don't get it right early on, then you're really gonna struggle later. And so I think it is a bit of a vicious cycle where you've got teachers who are poorly equipped and unable to teach in the earlier grades, and then you've got teachers that are overwhelmed by the backlogs that they receive in the higher grades.
And just finally, and I hate asking glib questions, but time is always against us. In the short term, given the urgency, is there a quick fix?
No, there's never a quick fix, Jeremy. Not in these kinds of things. I think we have to look at both. I think we can't just leave a generation of high schoolers without, you know, that aren't equipped to enter STEM degrees, or, you know, have the opportunity to thrive. But at the same time, we do need to start early on. And that's probably the most efficient way. The best value for money is to start in the early grades and get that right.
Some important food for thought there. Sarah Cairns, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, it's coming at us pretty quickly. The two-pot retirement system now a month away from implementation, and it is still the subject of much debate. The question is, what impact is this going to have on our already poor savings culture? Professor Adrian Saville, Professor of Economics and Finance at the Gordon Institute of Business Science and Head of Strategy at the Tennant Group of Companies, is with me now. And Adrian, do you think the system is going to improve saving habits, or are we going to fall short?
So I'll use the famous ceteris paribus from Economics 101 assumption, which is all else equal, Jeremy. Yes, it will improve savings. Keeping in mind, you know, two things, that this is not comprehensive. Not everyone belongs to a retirement scheme or a pension fund. And the second is the two-pot, or more correctly, two-component system is not fencing the entire saving pool of any person contributing to the system, but only that savings pot or that permanent pot. They will have access to a component along the way. So it's a significant improvement, but it's not everything.
And part of the problem is that it's difficult to put measures in place to ensure that any withdrawal is actually used for a financial emergency, yeah, and not, as South Africans are want to do, and that is spend it unnecessarily.
You know, Jeremy, I'm going to be, let me first be constructive. You know, we were talking about being half full rather than half empty, you know, optimistic as we go into spring. And in an ideal world, first, South Africans wouldn't need to access these funds. Now let's put in the economic or financial howevers. However, you know, South African households are strained, elevated inflation, deeply entrenched unemployment, and large levels of household debt. And the inflation has also translated into higher debt servicing costs. So households, if we look at the Reserve Bank statistics, are under pressure. And so I think it's natural or sensible to anticipate that when people do have access to this component, they're likely to use it to try and address some of that household financial stress. The second, however, though, is, however, South Africans are want to consume. We're a consumption-led economy. And based on that behavior, I think it would be sensible to expect or anticipate that people who do reach into that saving pool will use it to fund lifestyle rather than to pay down debt, which is particularly unfortunate because that doesn't solve the household financial stress issue.
I heard one economist saying it was akin to a heroin hit. Nice to have it the first time, and then it's going to be difficult to get later.
Well, you know, you will have this first go at it, and then as you go along, you are able to dip into this pot once per year at a minimum of 2,000 per dip. And there must be some science behind establishing, you know, why that 2,000 is the minimum viable distribution. But it is essentially a once-off rush. And having said that, though, I think that there's two further aspects that need to be managed. The first is, overwhelmingly, the size of these pots for South Africans are very small. These aren't grand sums waiting to be distributed. And the second is, they'll be subject to tax and the cost of the distribution. And so that's going to erode the size of those distributions. So there's so much here that needs to be done in terms of building financial literacy amongst South Africans to use this as an opportunity to reset and really help get the country into a position that people are saving for retirement. Unfortunately, you know, alongside the heroin hit, when historically, when South Africans have exited employment, overwhelmingly 90% of people exiting employment take the full pension and it disappears into a hole. It doesn't go into preservation, or might go down go to paying down household debt. But as you pointed out early on, we don't really know how to monitor that.
So should we not have gone the literacy route first?
Sure. You know, from your lips to the great creator's ears. And that we haven't is unfortunate. I think financial literacy should be a vital component, you know, from grade zero. Kids 6-7 years old should be taught the you know, the basic principles of finance. These aren't complex matters, but you know, in a country where you've got low levels of, you know, just literacy full stop and numeracy, this really complicates the issue. Having said all of that, you know, what we're speaking to in this particular conversation is people who are in employment, and you would anticipate that they would have better than most in terms of their literacy and numeracy. And part of the work that we're doing, that you know, the distribution, the material that I'm distributing with the tenant group, is to try and contribute to this important literacy narrative. There's a second article that we've just produced on the conversation, which speaks to some of the key things people should be doing in anticipation of the two-pot system, and that is an that is directly intended to contribute to literacy and contribute to the financial well-being of households.
Professor Adrian Saville, always good talking to you. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And let's end the program with this. As complaints about race relations continue to increase, the South African Human Rights Commission believes introducing diversity lessons in schools may help reduce such grievances. The commission releasing its annual trends analysis report this week, which shows that complaints related to race relations are on the increase. With us now is Zamantungwa Mbeki from the Human Rights Commission. And what then is driving, and welcome to you, driving this seemingly new wave of racial tension?
Thank you for having us, Jeremy. I really don't think it's a new wave. I think from our trends analysis as the commission, we are consistently every year getting complaints about discrimination and hate speech broadly, even in schools. I think if you remember last year, we had quite a high number of suicides in schools based on homophobic statements, whether they were said by teachers to learners or learners against each other. So I don't necessarily think that it is an increase, because from our side, our stats are telling us that we see this happening consistently in schools. Crawford last year, we saw what was going on in the classroom there as well. So I don't think it's new issues. It's just that once in a while they emerge and then they get the spotlight. But definitely schools are becoming the playground for this, where children are actually inheriting what their parents are either saying or what their parents are believing. The schools become a microcosm of what is actually going on in society. When we see some of the complaints and where utterances are being made, they're being made in the workplace. They're being made, the number of complaints that where people during a road rage incident will be saying utterances to each other, where people are making utterances within the home, within the same family, within the same family group. And there are all the spaces where children are. So when children are hearing this and it's going around them, also from our leaders on television, we're seeing that going on. Children are going to end up absorbing that information. And then the school becomes a playground or the microcosm of that.
So how would, first of all, a diversity education curriculum be constructed? And how do you think this might assist in resolving the problem?
It's a very, it's a two-lens approach. The law as it currently stands obviously gives us a framework which, when incidences happen, allows us to have a very tough legal approach using PEPUDA, taking people to the Equality Court, or going the SAPS route from a criminum in your area lens. But what it does not do is educate or show learners in their school and in the schools, or educate the learners within that prison. So what we've seen over the years is, when, if you remember, a few years ago, even with Nqebo Dlamini, one of the things that the complainants sought there was some training so that they could understand the context that the complainant is coming from. At the time, I think it was the Jewish Board of Deputies. But what we've seen is that if we just use this punitive approach without something coming behind to educate, to make people aware of the different social backgrounds, as well as the law, but not a very tough legal approach, but we show diversity training, and diversity and sensitivity training must be accompanied with these approaches, so that we can also change thoughts. We have to change thoughts as much as we seek sanction. We have to do what we are trying to do is to change thought, so that in the long term, there's some preventative mechanisms to make sure that this does not happen again.
Have you applied your mind, or has the commission applied its mind, to specific topics or themes that would be included in such training, and how they might be tailored to address the challenges that you've outlined that exist in South African classrooms?
Definitely. One approach is obviously to reflect on what has come to the commission before. There are different schools of thought on racism. There's different schools of thought on decolonizing. There's different schools of thought that we have to bring forward. And I don't think it's necessarily about bringing the views of the commission forward, but it's to reflect on what has come to the commission in terms of its complaints handling, and providing schools of thought to that in the diversity training, but also opening up discussions within the curriculum of why people believe what they believe. It's very important that we don't shy away from unpacking and giving a person the opportunity to break down why they believe what they believe, and where that information has also been taken from. So the curriculum as it is, it's not only unique to the commission. There's also other foundations like the Katrada Foundation, who've been providing sensitivity and diversity training over the years, is that you look first at the history, you look at the trends, you also then unpack it using the different theories that currently exist to unpack and maybe try to change thought.
How would you deal with the inevitable pushback that might come from some parents?
There is going to be pullback. I don't think one, even in a school background, when one's undertaking an investigation, I always say that we, when dealing with children, you have to understand that you're primarily dealing with the parents first, because the children do not have the consent or the power to come on their own to the commission. And it's important that we try to get the buy-in from the parents. When you get the pushback, you can't force any parent to participate, because at the end of the day, they are the ones who have to make the decision. But it's important from us to show that this, what we are talking about, is a systemic issue. It's not just an issue that is happening now at School X, or an issue that is only affecting School X. But the buy-in that we are seeking is to resolve the issue, and to most importantly have all sides heard. And I think when we sometimes feel that when we have an incident happen and there's so much media attention to it, every decision that the school made or XGB makes is under such public scrutiny. But in a couple of months, when this now is no longer a story, we are left with the people who are affected by it as the commission or as GDE. And it's important that on the one hand, we try to restore relationships, that we try to mend the relationships, but we're also cognizant that the right to education of the children and of the learners, that is also maintained. So the approach when dealing with children, it must not be always so harsh and so as to warrant resistance from the parents. We must be able to hear all sides, all right. And particularly with this Korea Girls issues, that there's so many facets to it, particularly coming from the parents of the affected learners.
Thank you very much for joining me today from the South African Human Rights Commission. Zamantungwa Mbeki, I do appreciate your time. And that also informs our question today, our online poll. Do we need formal race diversity education in schools? Yes, no, or would it really work? If you have a view, please go to X or LinkedIn. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.